those kinds of things. Yeah. I started this job 6 months before Harvey. And
wow, what a great time to start.
Yeah. So
oh,
as I was sitting in
you
my
started a maintenance job 6 months before
I was sitting in my game room on the second floor of my house because we were afraid we were going to flood.
Oh my
but
gosh.
We didn't. And I just looked at my husband and I said, my job just changed immensely. And it did for a year and a half after Harvey.
Welcome to another episode of the Beauty Avenue podcast. We have a special guest today, Ms. Deanna Ennis, who works with the Archdiocese of Galveston, Houston. Can you, so your official title is?
I am the Associate Director for Preventive Maintenance in the Office of Construction and Preventive Maintenance.
Awesome. Welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
So preventative maintenance, that sounds real exciting. What is your current day-to-day job?
Well, currently I'm kind of a resource or a consultant, within the diocese. I'm for the parishes, to try to help parishes, maintain what they have, their built environments and what they have. And also look at improvements, where we can improve and keep up to date, what's out there. And so that takes a lot of different forms. Sometimes it's a parish calling with a question. They need a specific type of contractor or a specialty that they don't have any experience with. So I do a lot of that. And on my side, that means I need to have a pulse on kind of the professionals out there, in every different,
lots of different
trade. And then I started about a year ago doing a series that I call Facilities Connect, which is basically a leadership and professional development and technical training series of, getting all of the folks at the different parishes, together on a monthly basis and, present a topic to
who comes to that
increase
sort of
their in, well on my mailing list. I have I try to have it invited to every session, the pastor, business manager, the facilities director if they have one. A lot of our parishes don't have that role. But really, and volunteers that are directly looking at that. Parishes are supposed to have a building and grounds committee, which can be partly staff and partly volunteers or, any mix. But unfortunately, a lot of our parishes don't have that. And so what I'm trying to do is get information out there, let them know what our office can do, how we can help them, and just kind of heighten the awareness. I'm also trying to build connections between parishes so that, I feel like every parish should know their counterpart professionals at the two or three, parishes. Most of our parishes are not any more than 3 or 4 miles away from each other. We have 150 parishes in the diocese.
Yeah.
So anyway, just trying to build those, connections, resources, and a lot
what's
of neat things have happened from
the,
that.
Not the diocese and not the parish, but what's the name of the sort of subgroup?
Deanery.
The deanery, that's right.
Deaneries.
Do you organize them by deaneries?
I don't because there's about 15 deaneries. So that breaks down to only about 10 parishes each.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
What I do is I just have 4 meetings in 1 week, and they're the same content. Mm. And I'll have one on the north side, one on the east.
Yeah, to make it easier for everyone to attend.
Just give them places in different days.
Yeah.
So, that's really,
kind of equipping the teams that are out there in some way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the structure of this conversation is going to be one where we talk about your experience in the diocese, but we're going to do that at the second half. I wanted to touch on that first just so people know where you're at currently.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to back up in time to your time at St. Lawrence, and we're going to focus just on your time in the parish and ask questions about that first, and then we'll work our way from the specific instance to the broader diocese, which is a network of those individual groups. So what was your role at St. Lawrence, and How was that?
So, my title, I was hired to be the director of facilities.
Okay.
There. And I think, the pastor knew at the time that he hired me, that there was going to be some building in the future.
Mm. Now, were you a replacement or were you the first facilities director?
I'm the first person that had the entire role. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was a fairly new position.
Mm-hmm.
My predecessor had some other duties as well. So, but that was my dedicated job.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he knew, at the time that we were going to need to expand our church at some point in time, maybe not immediately, but, and I came from kind of a whole another career, mm-hmm. but it tangentially, you know, had some construction exposure and exposure to a lot of different things. And then, mm-hmm. you know, basically, I had been involved in my parish. I love my parish.
Yeah.
And, you know, my husband and I had joined there after we got married, and my husband came into the church through RCIA, and we had some small children, and you know, that's where we spent a lot of our
at St. Lawrence.
Yeah.
That was your home parish.
Yeah. Well, that was my home parish, for my adult life, my married life.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Sure.
I did grow up in the diocese.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually in a similar type of parish, when we first joined St. Lawrence, it was sort of, I guess it was about a little over 10 years after the parish had been founded.
Uh-huh.
So, and the buildings actually were brand new. When we joined the parish, they had had the dedication the week before we joined the parish.
Oh, wow.
So we were living in brand new buildings
wow.
that we, you know, hadn't been part of the fundraising for and everything.
Uh-huh.
But when I took the job, it was about 10 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And we were already starting to bust at the seams.
Yeah.
So anyway, it was a growing area. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole Fort Bend County area is expanding,
yeah.
and that particular area, you know, had a lot of building going on.
Mm-hmm.
So we were gaining more and more,
yeah,
more parishioners.
Because now St. Lawrence is a huge place. I mean, mm-hmm. tons of buildings everywhere.
Yeah. It's
I mean, is St. Lawrence one of the bigger dioceses? I mean, one of the bigger parishes in the diocese?
Diocese inside of the town.
It has its own diocese.
Yes, it is probably, I mean, depending on how you classify parishes by members or square footage or a lot of different ways you can look at it.
Ones.
But we do have a very large K-8 school. It may be the largest we have. I don't know.
Yeah.
We're pushing at least 8,000 families.
Yeah.
And
we have a few parishes in the diocese that I think are probably in like the top 20 in the entire nation.
Yeah.
Like we probably have like five of the top 20 or something.
Yeah. So it is a very large place. And so the challenge there is, you know, knowing that it's large, trying to make it not feel large.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, have it be meaningful to, mm-hmm. and to everyone, that comes and attends.
It seems like they do that pretty well. I mean, from what I hear.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like it's a pretty vibrant community.
It is.
I've heard a lot of good things. I haven't been there personally, but I've heard a lot about St. Lawrence.
It has definitely, it has a lot to offer, lots of different styles of worship. Our music program is just fantastic.
Yeah.
We have, again, the school, so it appeals to families. We have an excellent small children's program from infants to say school age.
Yeah.
And so just a lot of things to appeal to a lot of different folks.
Mm-hmm. So when you were hired, you said you were hired with the implicit idea that there would be some new construction and that you would in some way be the liaison around that. Can you speak to what you see as speaking right now in this question to a priest who has been in his parish for 5 years, but starting new construction, has no idea how the team is structured.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about the kind of structure of the team in principle and how that played out in your project where you were kind of that person.
So, I mean, we're very fortunate in the diocese that we do have good advisors. So the director of construction, Steve Fott,
mm-hmm.
You know, is someone we always say, you know, call Steve first and, you know, get the advice. And the advice we were given is exactly what we tried to do. And I think it's great. It's proven to be great advice. We at St. Lawrence, we did this twice with two different building projects in about 8 years. And that is, you know, find building committee people and not very many of them, so you don't have to have a ton of them, that are first and foremost passionate about their faith and about the parish. We really don't feel like you need to load up on, you know, you have to have somebody that's, you know, an expert in construction, or you have to have, you know, somebody who's also an architect, or, you know, you have to have people that are engaged and understand what they're trying to create.
Yeah.
And more than anything, an atmosphere that they're trying to create, because I mean, really your parish should be your spiritual home.
You should
feel, you know, you should have everything there that, that you have at home. You have relationships, you have, you know, reminders of the past and hope for the future, and, and you have prayer, and you have learning, and I mean, all of these things. So, and if you're not completely engaged, it would be hard to fulfill an important role on a committee like that. So
how did the committee, what pre-work did you do? Meaning, I'll let that question ride. You kind of chuckled at it.
So, well, funny enough, we focused, largely on what I would just call the temporal things. So we had a church that we wanted to expand. And so we weren't creating something from nothing. It was clear that it was very important, because the church wasn't that old, that we needed to honor what was there. And so we weren't going to start completely from scratch. And so, you know, we had a collection of folks that were part of the building committee, and we actually had a sort of a feasibility or a study committee even before the building committee. So, that, you know, that was kind of different people that helped do the needs assessment to help determine what was it that we needed. Did we really need a bigger church? Did we need some other type of facility? And so, you know, that group really led into, you know, what the actual building committee was going to be. But I think really some of the best groundwork that we did was in interviewing and hiring, you know, the professionals that helped lead us. And every, you know, every committee is different. I can just, you know, say from my own experience, it's hard to listen to, you know, basically, presentations from design companies, firms, architecture firms that, you know, all have experience. I mean, you don't hire a home builder to help you build a church.
Right.
There's a limited, you know, number of folks that are good at this in our immediate area. So, you know, you listen, and really what it comes down to is you just feel like it's people. It's people working with people. Do these people seem like people that can work with our people? Because it is a financial, you know, client, professional relationship, but it's also a people relationship, and it's about something that means a lot to the parish. And so, at the end of the day, just really doing some serious discernment on that decision, I think, is some of the best work that a parish can do. I mean, not all design, you know, firms and people are created equal, and nor does every firm fit the group that's needing the work.
That whoever comes in with the lowest number is the best person for you.
Absolutely not.
Because they will, that doesn't mean that you're going to spend the least amount with them.
Right.
There are many times where, from top to bottom, like real specific trades on projects to actual consultants who charge lots of money for professional fees, where the cheapest person will cost you so much more in time and actual money for some sort of mistake that it's obvious thing.
I also think too, I mean, I've personally, through the work of the parish, you know, went through this enough, and then now at my position, you know, at the diocese, I've seen it many, many times over. that the money is not the money's fairly equal. Mm-hmm. But you have to have a relationship.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and the reality is that, you know, the building process is long. I think a lot of times people don't realize.
Exactly.
You're going to have to be working with these people for a long time.
Well, how long?
Hopefully.
How long? Let's put some real numbers. How long is that? What's your average?
Okay, so from the time that a parish does a needs assessment, and you're mm-hmm. unless you absolutely know what you're going to do, mm-hmm. There's some level of needs assessment that needs to happen. Mm-hmm. And so, that process, I think if done correctly, at the minimum would be a 6 to 8 month, process to get all the input that
for the needs assessment. Yeah.
That most parishes, really need.
Yeah.
And when I say that, I mean, you're going in, you're talking to committees, you're talking to ministries within the church, mm-hmm. You're getting input, mm-hmm. Your consultant, is learning about you as mm-hmm. a parish.
Yeah.
Bringing those smaller conversations to the larger group and realizing that the smaller conversations had really idiosyncratic things that are not the consensus of the parish, and that back and forth happens multiple times.
Exactly. To shorten that process, if you truncate that, you're probably losing some valuable information. Mm-hmm. So you're in a relationship there. And mm-hmm. then often for most parishes, after that's done, there's some fundraising that has to happen, mm-hmm. and that can be short or that can be long. I mean, it can mm-hmm. be, best case, you're probably looking at 10 months to a year, worst case, you may be several years. And then you go into the design process the design, depending on the size of the building and mm-hmm. That can take a year.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the building mm-hmm. can take a year. So, I mean, you're like 4 years. Right. So you better be good friends.
We're seeing some projects now that take two capital campaigns.
Yes.
They take one to start, mm-hmm. and then that gets you halfway there. Mm-hmm. And then you have to, hit the next one right afterwards, or else the escalation, the cost of waiting is going to hit you. Yeah. So it's sometimes even longer than that. So, it's an employee that you're hiring, quote unquote, for 5 years. Just top to bottom.
Yeah, from the architect's perspective, I mean, I think one of the more important things that we do is help with that consensus building.
Right.
That ends up getting buy-in from the congregation, because if you don't have that, then none.
Well, and I think that's, unless you've been through one of these processes mm-hmm. done well,
mm-hmm. right.
You don't understand that that's part of the architect's job.
Right.
And I certainly didn't understand that. As we went through the first process, I just kept thinking, oh my gosh, they're taking so much, time on this part, this figuring out what we need, we just need to expand the church and put mm-hmm. in 500 more seats.
Yeah. You just want to get going. There's a new pastor, there's a new committee, and they're like, let's just start building.
And
the thing.
But when I look back on it and reflected, mm-hmm. Back on it in the end, I thought to myself, oh my gosh, there are so many elements of that building today mm-hmm. that wouldn't have happened if mm-hmm. we hadn't included, this person and that person and all, just all of the different people that played a role in it. And that doesn't mean that they were sitting there, at the table all the time. Mm-hmm. Our arts and environments director, there were certain things that the church didn't have and, she thought that they needed to have and went back and forth and back and forth. And in the end, we built things into it that, mm-hmm. At the onset I thought, not sure I see the value in that, but now I'm like, I'm so glad we did that.
Yeah.
Right.
And she knew what she was talking about. And I that was an area that I wasn't mm-hmm. intimately, familiar with. Mm-hmm. So anyway, and you just multiply that with the music ministers and with the wedding coordinators with everybody.
And they'll have to work together too.
Exactly. Everybody that uses a place like a church. Mm-hmm. It's a community effort when it's done right.
And If you hit the ground running and just go straight into execution, then halfway through you realize you forgot some things.
Mm-hmm.
And once construction has already started, it's like, do you want to make awful decision one or awful decision two? There is no easy way to solve these problems.
Right.
So the there are two versions of pain. One is the pain of paying for it during construction, which is more excruciating than the pain of waiting and planning for a period that seems far longer than it ought to take.
Right.
So the consensus of the last 5 minutes has been, for whoever's listening to this that's involved in this type of project, that it's probably going to take longer than you want, but it's worth it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the church doesn't do anything really fast. And this is one of them.
That's right. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
There's you probably know, reasons for
from,
that.
From the architect's perspective, as far as what makes a good committee, mm-hmm. I mean, I've had the pleasure of working with several committees that I think were very, very good, very healthy. And one of the marks is just, first, that they respect you as a professional. You know, that they truly know that you're coming in to help the church. The other is that they recognize that you're on the same team. Mm-hmm. There can be sometimes an adversarial relationship with committees, and that
yes.
ends up being very difficult to work with, you know.
Yes.
And then also just the ability for the committee to feel comfortable with being honest mm-hmm. and saying, like, actually, we don't like that. You know, sometimes there are committees who just, because they respect you too much,
right?
They don't say anything, and then it's only after the fact that they say, well, actually, that didn't work.
Yeah, we had a situation on the second building project that we did where we were pretty far into the schematic design, and can kind of take a drawing, you know, in my head when I've got it pretty good. And I'm one of those people that can kind of see it in 3D and, mm-hmm. and imagine myself walking yeah. through it. And yeah. and a lot of people I've found can't do that. And so anyway, I was kind of doing that, you know, one evening. I was kind of thinking about things. I was like, man, this something doesn't feel right about this. Mm. And I concluded at the end of the evening, oh, my gosh, I think we've got the offices in the building wrong, and they need to go in the back, and the big meeting rooms need to come to the front. I'm going to have to tell the architect
your
that
architect in, our, dreaming.
In our next meeting, and he's going to kill me because we, you know, we had gone, you know, a little far down the road.
Sure.
But I was absolutely convinced that we were making a mistake.
Right.
And, you know, yeah, it was hard to open my mouth and say yeah. that. And, you know, he took a deep breath and he says, okay, I guess I can see that. And, yeah. mm-hmm. you know, it's that kind of go back and forth, mm-hmm. the process that he respected, you know, me as a facilities person there
right.
that he could see. Yeah. I can kind of see how that. And so anyway, it's mm-hmm. a lot of mutual respect. I think coming into a project like that, I had never worked with an architect before. And so I didn't have any preconceived notions. We had yeah. another person on our committee who had done a lot of work with architects mm-hmm. and kind of had some preconceived notions. Yeah. And I was kind of like, I'm not really sure why, you know, we have this little struggle. And I'm one of those people that I don't like the elephants in the room.
Right.
I like to name them.
Yeah.
And right. so sometimes, you know, just have yeah. to say, okay, what's really going on here?
Yeah.
Let's figure this out.
That's really important, I think, to be able to hold these two things in tension. Like it's a very Catholic thing to
yep.
be able to say, like, we need to both respect you as a professional and hear what you say and in some ways trust you. But at the same time, I need to be able to take what you have to task and say, you professional who you know, spend all day, every day doing this thing, mm-hmm. I think there's something maybe not quite right about that.
Right.
It takes a special kind of trust and humility to be able to, you know, receive what someone says, but also be able to say, you know,
on both sides.
Yes, on both sides.
On both
exactly.
sides, absolutely.
And not all architects are created equal. It's not that architecture as a profession, you know, sort of homogenizes all professionals.
Right.
But that sort of give and take is really difficult to do well and uncommon to have.
Well, and I think what you want to look for, to me, the key boiled down to you need to find somebody that's a good listener.
Mm-hmm.
If you're getting into meetings and they're not listening,
right?
That's a sign that things aren't probably going as well.
Yeah.
I mean, because they really need to be, you know, we had entire early, you know, meetings of before we got into design, but in the needs assessment phase where
yeah.
they weren't, you know, the architects weren't saying much. You know, at that point I wasn't sure, but later I thought, they were listening. They were soaking it in. They were hearing what we needed and what we wanted. And, it was
how,
really great.
How important is it, do you think, that the architect be Catholic and or Catholic in the sense that it like sort of, it's the organizing principle of their life. Like that they, there are some things you can tell someone and there are some things that you want them to intuit, and they don't necessarily have to, they may not be a Catholic at your parish and they may not know the culture of your parish, but how important is it that they live their faith?
I feel like that it, I would say it somewhat depends on what they're building.
That's fair.
I think that if you're building a church or you're building a chapel, I think that some leader from the design team needs to be Catholic because there are oddities, specialties, things that we do in our worship, you know, that are, you know, and sometimes it's just we do it once a year, Easter Vigil. That's a very particular very particular mass, and there's a lot of elements that need to be thought about, but it's important. It's the most important.
Sure,
and so we need to make sure that we design things that, that allow that, that to work. Same maybe for a chapel. If you're building a school, if you're building, you know, even, you know, multipurpose building, those I think are probably a little less important. I think they're a little more generic. But, you know.
You could say, to rephrase the question a bit more, to abstract at one level, you could say that for any building that has a specific type of program, it's helpful for the architect to in some way have an intimate connection to that program. So if it's a church, the question that I ask is a specific instance of, is it important that they're Catholic to, you know, to design a Catholic church? Is it important that they have a really, you know, strong conviction about pedagogy in order to design a school, you know, vice versa. So, I think that's totally fair. So we talked before about the sort of preparations before you build, and we talked about doing a kind of discernment and interview of the architect and other professionals, and doing a needs assessment. Are there any other steps before step one that you would advise a listening building committee member or pastor to, call Steve Fott if you're in, if you're in Houston.
Call the diocese.
Call the diocese.
That, you know, I think that unfortunately there's a lot of situations where that doesn't happen. That wasn't my experience at St. Lawrence. We were very, that was one thing Father Drew Wood is very particular about. He wants to be in communion with the diocese and make sure that, you know, that things are being done right. So, that was part of our, every day.
You feel that on average that parishes don't lean on the diocese enough for this kind of stuff?
Well, I think that, in our department, we work very hard to be of service. That's my predecessor in this job was an incredible mentor to me, Deacon Don Sanger. He from the day that I started at St. Lawrence, he reached out to me, and if I ever needed anything, and I did, I leaned on him a fair amount when I was a fairly new facility manager, because I wanted to make sure, that I was doing things correctly. And so I will always, be grateful to him for being such a great mentor to me in my role. And to me, that it was kind of natural. But so that's what we want to do. We want to help. We know that buildings, let's be honest, buildings are not the mainstream thing for the church. The role of a parish is to bring people to Christ.
That's right. First and foremost.
Not to build things.
It is, to have worship, to have catechesis, and to do outreach, and to do all of those things. And that's what they need to be really good at.
Yeah.
And honestly, they don't, most churches are not going to build a building. I mean, it's extremely unusual what we did at St. Lawrence when I was there.
Right.
We did $25 million worth of building in, you know, eight years.
That's not normal.
But so you may have other parishes that, you know, basically they'll do one project in a generation. So there's not a corporate memory there.
Right.
And maybe the pastor has done a building project in another location or something like that.
Right.
So I think that's what we try to be. That's what we try to. And a lot of things, you know, kind of get in the way. But there is a process. And we try to, you know, step parishes through the process, leaving them with the ability to make some of their own choices.
Right.
So it's not prescriptive.
Yeah.
And I think that in that way, a parish ends up, I mean, it's their money,
right,
that they're spending to do the project. And so we're not dictating what, you know, design team to use, what contractor to use. We'll give them recommendations, and kind of step them through the process. So that to me, yes, is a very important thing to, you know, whether you're in our diocese or really any diocese, that's where you should be turning, at least to get the process started.
To get it going.
You said that it's not your money. I don't want to jump into the diocese just yet, but real quick factoid before we jump back into parish stuff. Doesn't the diocese just pay for everything that the Catholic Church builds?
No, not at all. So building projects, parishes are set up to be self-sufficient. They have a leader. That's the pastor. Mm-hmm. And from a financial standpoint, the modus operandi is that they are going to be self-sufficient. They have their budget.
So if parish growth needs to happen, it doesn't happen because the cardinal, who just has finished his duties with USCCB, says, oh, by the way, St. Thomas More, I want you to add a classroom to your school.
No,
totally ground up.
He might say that. He might tell the pastor that, you know, although I somewhat doubt it, unless it's a parish that is in a very huge growth area. I mean, he might say, you know, hey, pastor, wouldn't you like to start a school? That might happen.
Right.
But he doesn't say, here's $1 million.
Yeah.
I'd like you to start a school.
He may say, under obedience to your ordinary, start fundraising. And then
So all of the property that you see at a parish came from the people within the parish. It was fundraised.
That's super important. I want to hammer that in this. Like everything you see at a parish is part of your geographic area, the parish you belong to. Your people fundraise and pay for everything that goes in your building. Your buildings, your staff, all the liturgical vestments, everything that happens there.
The community they're built.
The community supports what's there. And that's the norm. There are things that happen outside of the norm, but most of the time, the diocese doesn't swoop in and pay for, you know, new construction projects. And that's real important to, I think, realize that we need to own that.
Right.
And if there's something that's not quite right, it's partly because you need to be involved in it.
Right. And I think that's, you know, when you see a parish that maybe needs some new buildings or is in an area that, you know, maybe there is some growth coming. I mean, we have some parishes who are in areas of town that they see growth coming, but they're not in a position right now to be able to like buy an extra 5 acres or, you know, do what's necessary. So that's the reason why, because basically the funds to fund things come from within the parish. The diocese does not give money to parishes to do that. Now,
you talk about financing.
There are financing mechanisms.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, obviously, parishes fundraise, and there are some, you know, rules of thumb, you know, based on a parish's collection history and, you know, income and the pledges for campaigns and things like that. But the diocese does have savings and loan that helps fund and bridge financing. So all of that, you know, is done through through the financial arm of the diocese.
And you're not really involved in that.
Well, we are involved in it in as far as, you know, it impacts the building that can get done.
Yeah. But your office is not setting those numbers. You're involved more in helping organize the people and the professionals and giving direction for the work itself.
Right.
Yeah. So the numbers that I have heard, just to like be real practical with people maybe listening, are that if a parish wants to fundraise, they need to have something like 50% in hand.
That's the general rule of thumb, yes.
Yeah. So if you're wanting to build a building and you have gotten super rough orders of magnitude and your building is $8 million, you need to, before it just like, you know, napkin sketch stuff, you need to have $4 million in hand or else there is no help funding by the diocese or financing or whatever you're going to do. So that's just like...
That's correct.
Yeah. So... If the parish is going to grow, and if there's a desire for a new sound system or a new building or something like that, that typically happens at the parish level, right? It begins with a pastor or an interested staff member or parishioner who takes the lead on that.
That's correct.
They reach out to the diocese, you or Steve or someone else or whoever, whatever diocese you're in, to see what other professional connections they have and kind of build up from there.
Correct.
So, just structurally, that's the way that things typically operate.
Right.
So, you know, good old Catholic distributism. Yeah. It's like at the lowest, and this is an important point to note. It's not just at the lowest possible rung of control. It's at the lowest competent place. So, at the lowest level of competency, that's where problems should be solved. So, there's a lowest level, but if it's incompetent, it needs to go up a level.
Right. Well.
I'll leave the determination of competency.
Yes.
The judgment call.
So there are a few more questions I have before we jump to questions at the level of the diocese. One of them is work specifically for liturgical projects. Can you speak about working with professionals that had or didn't have experience designing liturgical spaces or, you know, something about how that was like a successful project with, you don't have to name names if you don't want to, but I'm wondering about how the parish should go about evaluating professionals who have or don't have experience designing a church.
Right.
Because there's often a guy who's the parishioner, who's a son's cousin's uncle.
Well, I think that's where the diocese does come in. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, typically, if a worship type space, I mean, is going to be contemplated, then they're supposed to call the diocese and, and we'll give them recommendations on who to talk to. Mm-hmm. So if we know that they're contemplating a church or a chapel or something like that, then there's a list of probably four or five firms that, you know, and that list isn't static.
Sure.
That list, you know, has morphed and changed over time. And that's based on, you know, who's doing work and who's with what firm, you know, that changes too sometimes.
Right. Yeah,
And so, you know, every once in a while, you know, a church will say, well, you know, we want to use this guy out of San Antonio or Austin or something like that for some reason, maybe the pastor went somewhere and saw this fantastic church or, you know, that's not super common, but it does happen.
Right.
There are problems with that just in logistics. Sometimes, you know, we've also had some situations where, you know, a firm wanted to use sort of the designer being from, you know, some place way out of the state.
Yeah.
And they'll use another firm here to do the detailed drawings or something like that. So, I mean, there are things that can be worked out if there's a real need. But, you know, generally the group of architects that we have in the Houston area, you know, typically meet most of our needs. And and that's kind of where it starts.
So speaking specifically to what you had
I was just going to ask, does the diocese review the design of a building?
Right. So, yes. There are milestones along the way that once a project is in schematic design.
Mm-hmm.
We've got some drawings to kind of look at. There is a diocesan review committee, and it consists of some staff folks like myself, some mm-hmm. folks from the liturgy office.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a school, the Catholic schools office,
yep.
That are on this standing committee. We have a couple of pastors who have some, you know, expertise in little liturgy particularly and,
right.
and, in music and that sort of thing. And so, we will review those. We'll have a presentation. The design team will come in with the parish and kind of show us what they're thinking of, and we'll ask some questions. And, you know, this group, that it's sort of like a little forum, and,
right.
And we typically kind of get to know each other. So over time, the designers typically know the kinds of things that we're going to be concerned about looking
sure.
at. I mean, I have my pet peeves.
Sure, right.
that I always look at designs and want to know, you know, want to make sure that things are maintainable.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll ask questions
sure.
about, you know, where the HVAC maintenance areas are, and
yeah.
and does the lighting, you know, is it accessible? Mm-hmm. Can we get
right.
can we change light bulbs? That's
yeah.
kind of
yeah.
a and finishes, some finishes, you know,
mm-hmm.
are
mm-hmm.
a little bit, you know, if a church is coming in and they're going to have some, you know, highly polished, you know, marble floors, I'm going to make sure that they understand what the maintenance is on that
right.
sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because
that's part of the ministry though. Like if people make decisions that are extremely costly, that could be 3/4 of a staff member.
Well,
and you've translated into,
there's
you know,
that. And the other thing that I also have seen and something that we look at. So this process of review is actually, we'll review one project at least twice,
right.
sometimes mm-hmm. three times mm-hmm. as it goes
yeah.
through
required.
The design process.
Each,
yeah.
each phase,
yeah.
each
it's
phase.
Kind of the
right.
milestones are where you're going.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what I'm typically looking for too is I worry about sometimes our parishes that spend every cent that they have on a building,
mm.
and maybe they already have some existing facilities.
Right. Mm.
And, you know, and I'm concerned that they're not thinking about, you know, the 40-ton air conditioner in their other building
mm-hmm.
that's
yeah.
already
almost
20 years old.
Yeah.
And
right.
so, you know, sometimes I'll ask, you know, some questions just about that, because
yeah.
we can get really excited about the new stuff and kind of forget about
yeah.
the old stuff.
The rest of the campus.
yeah. yeah.
And then the other thing that happens very frequently on our projects is, you know, our eyes are always bigger than our stomach. So,
mm-hmm.
so we designed something that's, you know, big, that we can grow into,
yeah.
And then maybe sacrifice for a less expensive roofing system,
right.
or mm-hmm. a less expensive, HVAC system. And, or just these sorts of things that fall
yeah.
into the category of value engineering.
Sure.
Cost but,
reduction.
Right.
yeah, it's really cost reduction.
We had a guy come into the office recently, like a legal guy who was, he basically said, value engineering is a term that we're trying to actively avoid. You should just call it cost reduction.
Yeah.
It's never adding value. It's always about cutting costs.
Right.
So.
I mean, there are a few things that, you know, we've made. I can remember making decisions on and thinking, oh, that was actually less expensive and much better.
And better.
Much
yeah.
better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That does happen.
That does exist.
But, you know, by and large, they end up being in the building envelope
mm-hmm.
or in the mechanical systems.
Yeah.
Which then really the church ends up paying for over
right.
and over
for the life
next,
of the building.
Exactly.
Because yeah.
mm-hmm. they're not things
yeah.
that are easily changed
mm-hmm.
And they're not
from a technology
are,
standpoint. So,
and they're not things that are typically amortized over windows that are obvious. Like
mm-hmm.
you look at the cost today to cut a check to install it, but not over the course of 20 or 30 years. How many times are we going to pay over and above what we just put into the window?
Right. And unfortunately, because of the way the process goes,
mm-hmm.
The parish often doesn't have the opportunity to really understand what that ongoing cost is
mm-hmm.
in the future. Because,
yeah.
again, a lot of our parishes, if they're building one of their first buildings, they don't have a maintenance staff there yet.
Yeah, they don't.
They don't even have the people that are going to be doing that day to day maintenance work, and so they don't know what it's going to cost. They don't. Now, for a newer parish, for an older parish that has some existing, one thing that I also see, unfortunately, a little too often, is that the maintenance people that are there are not included in the design process. So they're not, you're not getting the input from the guys that are maintaining the air conditioning system or whatever. And so those are, you know, maybe they don't want to be on the committee every day, or maybe that's not the most appropriate thing, but there are points at which everyone who has a particular expertise
should
at least have the ability to have some input. And I find that to be a little.
How many parishes do you think have, either by number or say there's 146 parishes based on the website,
150.
So there's 150 parishes in the Archdiocese of Galveston, Houston. How many by number or percentage do you think have a full-time facilities director?
Probably about 10%.
10%.
10%.
Do you think that's because only 10% of them are big enough to need it, or
that's part of it? The other thing is that, you know, sort of on the next tier of parishes, I mean, it might be.
I'm surprised by that number. I'm surprised by that number.
It may be fifth. It may be there. May
sure.
Be 15
even if
of them out
plus
there,
or minus 100%, seems like it's still low.
So what happens is the business administrator, the parish administrator, that's kind of a general title. They often will have that role. Right. So they'll
seems
have
like that person often has many roles.
They do. That,
all of the roles
that
besides
Bass wears a lot of hats. That person will probably be doing personnel, be over the financial, you know,
their HR, their everything.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that, you know, there are things that, you know, could be done differently. I think that if we could get a couple of parishes to kind of smaller parishes to cooperate with each other, that you could have a regional, like a facility manager that kind of could oversee two or three, especially if they don't have a school. Are the schools where you have a school, you know, those facilities get used.
Absolutely.
When you've got, you know, a couple hundred kids there every day. And
it's like the Ablaze model. It's like you're familiar with the Ablaze Ministries?
No.
There's a buddy of ours that runs a ministry. I think it's based in College Station, but they, you know, there's a lot of small churches or parishes in the Bryan College Station area, and they can't afford to hire a full-time youth minister, let alone youth ministry staff.
Yeah.
So Ablaze is a ministry that recognizes this need and has at least two youth ministers per parish, but they're spread across multiple parishes.
Mm-hmm.
So they've basically done what you're describing, but for youth ministry, and it's financially viable for them, and, you know, provides a ministry that's just basically not happening, or it's like someone's mom who's there for two or three years and leaves or something. So they're regional. Basically.
Yeah. So in fact, you know, we just hired in the diocese, a new staff member to our department who is designated to be the facility manager over the inner city Catholic schools.
Oh, that's great.
And, so we're really excited about, I mean, it's a very new model.
Yeah.
And
those
are
all needing lots of work.
A lot of cooperation, but it is kind of the first little bit of trailblazing that we're trying to do to see, because I've been, you know, kind of working with a number of those parishes, not only the school, but the parish as well.
Yeah.
So we'll see, you know, if that model can work. And
It seems intuitively like a right step or an obvious step. So it's exciting.
Yeah.
Trying new things. Yeah. Whoever says the diocese as an experiment.
Well like you said, the reality that parishes do not build very often, but that having that expertise would be helpful.
Right.
But if you pool it over several parishes, maybe it makes more sense than having it just in one place.
Yeah.
So I just had a thought. What is the difference between preventative maintenance and maintenance?
Because
the role is preventative
you're kind of splitting hairs there. Okay. But I mean, maintenance is really things that you know you need to do all the time, like you know, lubricate systems or whatever. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that you could say that's preventative, but preventative is really looking a little deeper, looking for maybe on an HVAC system, looking for signs of wear on, you know, wiring. Mm. I mean, is something rubbing against something so that it's going to cause me a problem, you know, down the road. It hasn't failed yet, but, you
paying
know, I need
$100
to,
now instead of $1,000. Right. Later.
So not waiting until it breaks.
Well, yes. And, you know, for churches, just like a lot of places, I mean, downtime, you want to avoid downtime because the problem with our downtime is it's on a Sunday.
That's right.
Or on a Saturday. And those are overtime periods for, for trades. And so we'd rather catch those problems, you know, during the week and, and try to avoid.
Stay ahead of it.
Yeah. Because nobody wants to be in mass for an hour with no air conditioning in July.
That's a bad recipe.
You got way more, way too many reasons for people not to show up to mass. The last thing we need to do is give them one more.
Let's take a moment, take a break so I can save it.
Okay. We're rolling. So one more question before we pivot to diocese level questions, if that's like a thing.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about project managers, and I guess before I ask the question, I'll say, for people who aren't aware of what architects do, the role of the architect is to provide for the health, safety, and welfare of the occupants of buildings, and what that means is that the architect takes all the disciplines involved in getting a project built, so we'll take structural engineers, mechanical engineers, acousticians, lighting consultants, landscape architects, civil engineers, and a multitude of other trades. And all these people have very specialized expertise in exactly what they do and nothing else. The structural engineer does not care what the building sounds like.
Right.
And the mechanical engineer does not care what the grills look like.
Right.
And the landscape architect does landscape very well, but doesn't do civil engineering very well. And it's the architect's job to be the composer. You take all the instruments in the song and you put them together and make sure they all sound beautiful together. So it's the architect's job to do all these things and to provide for what I said in the beginning, which is the health, safety, and welfare of the occupants of a building, which means we have to make the building safe. Mm-hmm. So we have to make sure that in the event of a fire, all the occupants can get out of the building. And on top of all of that, making it work, making sure the building doesn't leak, making sure that it meets the budget requirements and the use requirements of a client. We have to make sure that it's beautiful.
And I just want to say that that's an amazing number of things to try to coordinate.
Yes.
Whether it's on a new building or, you know, one that's being renovated or changed. And I always tell folks, you know, who call me and they want to, sometimes they want to make some little change or something. And my response, because I'm not an architect, I know just enough to know sometimes, you know, we really need to get a professional look at that because I understand that you just want to move this door or, you know, whatever. Right. Do you want to change? Do you want to make a ramp here? But what you and I don't fully appreciate and understand is all of the things that
triggers.
That triggers. Exactly. And so that's the reason why, unfortunately, sometimes you'll go to a property and you'll see, you know, a ramp where there wasn't one before.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can look at it now and know, yeah, that's way too sloped.
Right.
That's not, you know, the intention was right. We were trying to help, you know, folks with mobility, but the execution was not right. It was easy and it was probably cheap.
Right.
But it doesn't, it doesn't meet the code.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, so definitely that is always my fallback, and I think unfortunately, our most people, I won't say just in parishes, but I think, you know, just in general, you say architect and they automatically get scared like, okay, this isn't big enough, you know, I'm not building a new building. I'm not, you know, this is not big enough. And so, a long time ago though, I got over the fear of like, I can call an architect and have them just look at one little piece and it doesn't cost a fortune.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't have to be a huge project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It can be just like you can call a lawyer for an opinion about something,
yeah.
or a
yeah.
doctor.
Right.
I wish we got paid like a doctor.
Or a lawyer.
Well, yeah.
And very honestly, most of the time, I mean, often I've called on these kinds of things and I don't get charged anything.
Sure.
Because they know that I'm going to be doing something or building something or something
right.
later.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
You help out. And they're yeah. willing to share, you know, mm-hmm. their expertise for the church and, yeah. and yeah. that sort of thing. Now, if it gets to be complicated, yeah. They'll say, hey, you know, we're going to need a couple hours to mm-hmm. design this right. or mm-hmm. whatever.
Yeah. Sure.
So.
Yeah. So the preface to the question.
Didn't mean to cut you off.
No,
there,
it's great. It's great. I'm trying to fill in the gaps of people who, we use the word architect, and we know all that implies.
Right.
But other people may not fully understand the role of the architect and what they do and they don't do. And specifically, as it pertains to designing churches, there are typical contracts that architects use for construction, and they're designed by the AIA, the American Institute of Architects, and these are used on all sorts of projects. So they're very standardized.
Generic.
And they include descriptions of what the architect is going to do, the services they're going to provide, and they define other things about the project so you know exactly what the scope is. But there are things in churches that are outside the scope of typical architectural services, and I'm wondering about the times that you have or haven't, the times you have or have not had project managers involved.
Let me add on to that because I think I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, yeah. Go right ahead.
And that is that there is a whole aspect, especially working with churches, that is the project management of the project. So we talked about how as an architect, you have to build consensus among the committee.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You have to help educate committee members because some of them have never worked with architects, have never worked on a building process. And I think part of our job is to help explain to them what's happening every step of the way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And not all architects are good at that because, you know, other architects that work mainly
Everyone
with
has
developers.
Their charisms and their
That's
skills.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that's part, I think part of what our company does is we say that is part of our job, you know, to educate, build mm-hmm. consensus, manage the project. And honestly, it's to make the building process as enjoyable as possible
Definitely.
For yeah. the church, right?
Absolutely.
Well, in some other dioceses, you know, for example, Dallas, that has been taken away from the architect proper, and they have introduced a new role, which is the role of the project manager,
mm-hmm.
which now, you know, essentially bifurcates that mm-hmm. that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's where you're going with it.
Yeah, yeah, and it specifically, so there's a project manager role, and Dallas is a good example. There's a person whose full-time job is to manage projects, and the architect is not typically responsible for coordinating things that are outside of the scope of project, contractually speaking.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been involved in some projects that have various degrees of involvement with the architect. And I'm wondering if you can, before I fill in more gaps than I want to, if mm-hmm. you could just speak to what you see the role of the architect being on liturgical projects and what to look for.
Well, I think that... you know, I can speak a little bit from my experience
mm-hmm.
in a church expansion. So,
yeah.
In that case, many of our liturgical elements existed. I mean, we had an altar, we yeah. had an ambo, we had things that we did not want to redesign. Mm-hmm. Although, I mean, That's with easy. A different pastor, that could yeah. have been you yeah. know an element. Yeah. Now we did. We did want a new tabernacle.
Mm-hmm.
The diocese didn't like our mm. tabernacle. It was mm. wood. It was made of wood. And that was repeatedly mentioned when the bishop would visit. He didn't think that was great. And so so we took that opportunity to get a new element in our... Mm-hmm. And so we could have hired someone... yep. other than the architect
right.
To help us with, you know, just handle that.
Yeah.
We chose not to do that. We
right.
chose to kind of have our architect, and we had a few artistic folks that were in the parish.
Mm-hmm.
that wanted to participate in that. And so that kind of was a subcommittee that kind of went off, and they kind of brainstormed about the shape and, you know, the elements and then the actual artwork on it. And then we kind of took all that with the assistance of our architect and took it to, you know, a fabricator, a liturgical art fabricator.
Yeah, yeah. That's
and, cool. you know, out in Spain, and they made it and they shipped it over and we did that.
That's awesome.
Same thing with in that project, we added a huge stained glass window to, we had three that were existing, and there was an opportunity for a fourth. And so rather than hire somebody else, we went back to the original designer of the other three because we wanted it to be, you know, sort of in the same vein. And we had, again, a group, a little committee of artists, and they brainstormed with the pastor about what should the work of art be, what should the subject be. And you know, they decided it was going to be Mary at the Pentecost, because we didn't have any Mary in our stained glass. And so, you know, that just went down the road to design. And so I think what I love about that is that it was very organic to our parish. It was fairly easy then, you know, to really, I hate to say this, but to fundraise, because we didn't go buy something off a shelf or out of a catalog or whatever.
Yeah,
it was yours. Made from the people that were there in the parish. And, but our architects supported us, you know, in those ventures. And so, you could hire a liturgical designer. Those are out there.
Right.
And then they come in and I don't know how, you know, they do their work. I'm sure. And I've met other parishes, that have done that, but,
it's part of what I want to highlight.
We typically don't see that in our diocese.
Yeah. Most parishes don't do this, but what you can do is you can hire a liturgical consultant who like as a job, they're not architects typically. Sometimes they are, but they just design liturgical furnishings. Like, they'll design your altar, and they have specialized, you know, training and education and like liturgy. So that's a sort of hyper-focused thing you can do. It's limited scope, and it's pretty uncommon, I'd say.
And it will depend on the architect you select to begin with. Some architects will be more versed in liturgical furnishing and church design.
Yeah.
Some won't. And so you might want to consider a liturgical designer to supplement their skills.
That's exactly the point I was trying to get at. There are some architects that have, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but have no business doing church work.
Yeah, but I think
couple them with a liturgical designer, then I could see the sensibilities that you would want to have in play, having enough influence for the church to turn out well. I think it's, if you have an architect who's never designed a church and you have no one on, you know, the committee or any other professional who's got a specialty in this, then you should expect something that's going to be exactly what you signed up for, which is like fine, but not exceptional. And you should want your church to be exceptional.
The other thing too, to be quite honest, is a lot of this kind of comes from the pastor.
Yeah, that's true.
We have pastors who are, you know, they're just dying to do a new church, and they've got a lot of ideas, and they is their passion, and you know, they're going to carry that through. And then and then there are others, you know, who, you know, they see, well, you know, this is the 12th parish that I've been at, and they're all different, and they're all lovely in the way, you know, that they're different. Different communities. I mean, if you do a tour of the churches of the Archdiocese of Galveston, Houston, I mean, you're going to see some amazing differences.
Oh yeah,
all over the place.
They're all over the place.
So anyway.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's fair. Yeah. So I guess the point that this all began with, that I was trying to hit at with describing the role of the architect, is, it's not in the architect's professional training to design all of the parts of a church. an architect will be able to design you buildings that are safe and that are efficient. But odds are you need to have someone who has a specialty in understanding something of the heart of the church in order to be able to address it well. So,
right.
Yeah, that's it. So moving to the diocese, what's your, so we know your role is the director of preventative maintenance. What is your day-to-day like? Like, what do you spend your time mostly doing?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's never dull and it's never the same one day yeah. after the other. You know, just for example, driving to work this morning, I had a phone call from a pastor mm-hmm. who, we'd been working together on a new air conditioning system for his church because he's a new pastor. We get a lot of changes of the guard in July. And mm-hmm. so by this yeah. time of the year, we'll have new pastors yeah. that have issues and they need help. And so
they've done their 6 months of listening and now they're ready to get down to business.
And in this case, yeah. you know, our temperatures this morning were
freezing.
Uber cold.
Yeah, it was so cold. Yeah.
So apparently, he had no heat. So anyway, so I spoke with him about that and, you know, so that was on the way to work. And then I also, and that while I was on the phone with him, I had a phone call from a, one of our schools, principal at one of our schools that, is working together with the parish to replace some asphalt that's, causing some tripping hazards in their parking yeah. lot. And so they needed to have some advice about, you know, how to go about all of that mm-hmm. and the funding and all that sort of mm-hmm. thing. And so, you know, by 10 o'clock in the morning, I had already had, you know, two conversations about yeah. paving and HVAC systems. Mm-hmm. And then we had actually set up a meeting with a vendor this morning to talk about some novel flood prevention mm-hmm. and flood mitigation. Mm-hmm. So we sat with mm-hmm. this vendor for a couple hours to learn more about flood mitigation because one of our parishes, their school flooded twice in the last 3 months or mm-hmm. 3 or 4 months up at St. Martha's. And they're going to deploy.
Keywood, is that the only
yeah, Keywood? And they're going to deploy some of those strategies.
Like
but,
Imelda, they flooded in Imelda.
Yeah, they,
wow.
they flooded.
Oh, man, I didn't realize
they flooded
that.
In May, right toward the end of the school year, huh. and then they were out of the building for the whole summer, getting yeah. things restored, and then Imelda, they flooded
again.
Again.
Wow.
So,
wow.
And they're a large school. And,
they're huge.
And so,
yeah.
So anyway, that was very unfortunate. And so we're looking at this vendor, to see what he could do for us in some of our other locations. Actually, Imelda, St. Philip in Huffman flooded, Harvey and then again at Imelda. Mm. And, so that parish is really, kind of devastated. They were in their church for only a year and
sure.
then now they're out
yeah.
of it again.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm always looking for new, new approaches, new things out there.
Yeah.
I always say, if I'm not learning something, I'm probably dead.
Yeah. I mean, you're like solving problems. There's nothing theoretical about your job at all.
No,
it's like we have a pressing need now. How do we solve it as soon as possible, as effectively as possible?
It's very practical.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I kind of like to think of myself as sort of, you know, this little dating service where I get, you know, the people
right.
that need
pair up the right.
You're a matchmaker.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, those are, I mean, and sometimes it's the same thing over and over again. Later in the afternoon, I had another air conditioning issue with another parish that, you know, they'd had a new system put in and things weren't working quite right. So
yeah.
I spent a lot of time going between, you know, the parishes and maybe a vendor that needs to step up and, you
yeah.
know, anyway.
So, it's funny. Earlier when you're talking about trying to have a regional facilities manager,
mm-hmm.
it strikes me that in some way you're doing that job of like sort of regionalizing some of that role. And I hadn't really thought about that. And
yeah.
We talked about it before, but it's...
I'm a consultant. You
sure.
Know, I started,
for everyone.
It's funny. I started my career out of college in a consulting firm,
environmental
engineering consulting firm. And so I kind of know what that is to, you know, I learned how to be a project manager, how to be a consultant. Sure. And it's just, you know, problem solving, because every parish is different. Every building is different. Mm-hmm. Every situation, you know, is different. Yeah. You learn some things here. You try to take what you learn and move them over to another place. And that was really, you know, I love my parish. I loved, you know, the time that I was facility director there. It was a 24/7 kind of thing. I was, you know, all religious holidays, you know, I was
work.
Home, you know, so the holidays weren't, you know, but my family was great. They were very proud of me. They're proud of their parish.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter's going to be married, you know, in January in the church that I helped design on the interior, with the thought, as I was doing that, you know, someday I hope my kids are going to get married in this church. And I'm really proud of it. And so that's happening. Yeah. And so I'm excited about
that's awesome.
But you know, I felt this little tug, because St. Lawrence is an extremely blessed place. I'm extremely blessed, that I can make choices, and, that I really felt that I had learned so much there that, that I felt maybe could be brought out to other, places. And so when that call came to ask me to consider, you know, making this change, it was a very difficult decision, but, you know, I try every day to see if there's something that I've learned, you know, I learned way back when that I can help someplace else. So if I keep that in perspective, then everything else is gravy.
Yeah. I can keep on going through these. Do you have any questions?
Well, I was just going to say, I think that's really great, because it seems like, I mean, and this goes for most of the economy, right? There are certain companies that do things really well. There are certain parishes that are doing things really well. And I've often wondered, how do we export that to other parishes?
Yes.
You know, how do we share the knowledge, the culture that makes this particular parish really great, and spread it around?
Well, so I think that's the direction I'm heading in.
Yeah.
But what I do know is that you have to have a network first. You have to have a trusting network of people. Because the other fact is, I mean, none of us have enough time in the day.
Yeah.
And while you're, you know, while I was at St. Lawrence focused on making every day, you know, better there, I really didn't have much time
to think about anybody else.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, from time to time, you know, I would get phone calls from other parishes, because maybe the diocese knew that I had experienced something, or I knew something, and they'd say, oh, you know, Deanna's dealing with this over at St. Lawrence. Why don't you give her a call? And so I would definitely, you know, try to make myself available, you know, for those situations when they came up. But, you know, in terms of having a forum and sitting down and sharing best practices and that sort of thing, I always thought, why isn't the diocese doing that?
Right. Yeah.
So, now I'm in the position to be able to try to make that happen. And it's very difficult. I mean, it is very difficult, because as people are going through their daily life, you'd say, oh, they're doing something really great over here. Can we not, you know, leverage that in this other place? The only way that can really happen is if people know each other, if people get together, and and you create a forum to make that happen, and you have to make connections with people, and it takes time.
Right.
And so right now I'm trying to lay the groundwork, provide information and knowledge, and create an atmosphere where people can do that. But, you know, we have, within the diocese, we have vastly different, you know, age of buildings, types of construction, you know.
Culture of parish and approach to building and maintenance and everything.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So many.
So do you think, to try and name the thing that it seems like you're describing, if we could call it a feedback loop, do you think that there's an effective feedback loop at the level of, I mean, it sounds like you're basically trying to, like, your job at this point is to create that sort of loop so that parishes can, like, hear something and then like distribute the information back out to everyone else, and then reconsolidate it, find the best solution, and it's that sort of cycle that is
right.
Kind of like what your job is. It's not really to like it's sort of solve individual problems, but it's mostly to distribute the capacities and knowledge to all the people back out in the
right. Devices. And I also don't want to be, you know, sort of the pivot point on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everyone's
waiting for you.
Right. No, that back. Can't, you know, right. that can't be.
Yeah. Because as soon as you're unable to do it, the system
that's
breaks.
That's right.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to create is the connections between, you know, between
totally.
The individuals. And sometimes, you know, we think, oh, spatially, you know, the parish 2 miles down the road. Well, unfortunately, sometimes the parish 2 miles down the road doesn't have the same issues that you do.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So a parish like, you know, back when I was at St. Lawrence, we kind of ad hoc, a group of us facilities and parish administrator type folks, we were all large parishes with large schools. That was kind of the criteria to come to lunch.
Yeah.
And so there was about 8 of us, you know, parishes, and a few of those folks are, you know, still out there doing what they do. Mm-hmm. And, but I know them from, you know, 10, 15 years ago when, we would just get together and kind of, some of it was commiserating and some of it was learning.
That's a fair amount
you know,
of commiserating.
Learning
that's
from
how you,
each other.
That's how you make friends.
But that's part of it. That's building the trust.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
building
yeah.
And so what I try to do now is, you know, we have just, for example, for vendors, you know, whether it's design folks or, you know, folks that do electrical work or HVAC or whatever, you know, I have some folks that I rely on, but I know out there they have folks too. And so that's part of what I'm doing now is you tell me who's working well for you so I can share that, you know, and we'll get a list. We'll get those resources out to folks so that, at least, you know, in some ways, you know, from a financial standpoint and every other way, you know, we act small on a parish level, but we're big. And we can be big, and we can leverage that
and you
to our benefit.
And you want to fast forward some of those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to have someone have to do something that you could just help them move 8 hours down the line.
Yes.
Like you want to fast forward some decisions, and you want them to be able to, you know, take advantage of the institutional knowledge that you're providing.
Right.
So.
And so right now we're in the building trust phase and, you know, all of those kinds of things.
Yeah.
I started this job 6 months before Harvey. And
wow, what a great time to start.
Yeah. So
oh my gosh.
As I was sitting in
you
my
started a maintenance job 6 months before the biggest storm in Houston.
I was
history.
Sitting in my game room on the second floor of my house because we were afraid we were gonna flood.
Oh my
but
gosh.
We didn't. And I just looked at my husband and I said, my job just changed immensely. And it did for the year and a half after Harvey. You know, our office was pretty much focused on just helping those parishes that flooded get back and with FEMA and you know it's a lot of a lot of stuff but it was a great time to actually you know learn and understand more about what the needs of the parishes were so anyway
so do you is your focus just on parishes or is it also like a straight Jesuit part of your scope of work?
No. So
the prisons or anything?
The things that I'm focused on are what are owned by the diocese.
I see. Yeah.
So all of the lower schools, the K-8 schools that are attached to a parish, and that's almost all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all diocesan.
Mm-hmm.
Strake and the all of the high schools are either independently run or owned by
religious
an order.
Orders. Yeah.
Right. So no.
Yeah.
I know some of those folks and I'm actually trying to bring them into our network as well for for the purpose of networking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you know, and they are you know, some of them are gaining knowledge, you know, and but I don't have any responsibility there.
Yeah. So canonically the way all that is set up, the priests are operating as a ministry of the bishop, so every parish is an extension of the bishop's ministry in the diocese. So, and this is just you know a little factoid for all the people
inside
listening.
Baseball.
Yeah, a little insider baseball. So the priest he serves at the pleasure of the bishop, and it's really the bishop's ministry that he's partaking in. So the bishop ordains the priest, and he you know, has, you know, certain vows that he takes, and it's really his ministry that they're partaking in. So part of why this is interesting is, like, the diocese, the reason why the diocese to me is relevant is it's like, I don't envy the position of the bishop, because you're responsible for the soul of 1.7 million Catholics.
Right.
Like,
well, and the other thing that you kind of gloss over by saying all of that is that, I mean, I don't know the exact proportion, but it's rather large at this point. Of our pastors, who are the leaders of the parish, are not diocesan priests.
Less than 50%.
That's right. I saw that. That was very surprising.
Of the 400 something?
They are not diocesan priests.
Over 50% are religious order priests.
Yeah. So they're religious order priests. And by and large, that means that they are coming to us as a mission.
Absolutely.
As the diocese, as a mission. Yeah. And so, you know, that means, you know, we have priests from all over the world. And, you know, that is a challenge, because sometimes where they're coming from, you know, when we're talking about facilities, where they're coming from, you know, things that we have, that are normal in commercial buildings, like a grease interceptor in a kitchen, a commercial kitchen, or I don't know, sometimes air conditioning, or
I ain't got time for that. I'm going to kick that out of there.
Well, that's just not something that they know anything about. I mean, they just literally don't know that it exists. Mm-hmm. And so I have one particular priest that, you know, we've become very close over time because his parish flooded, and he was just so many things that he's had to learn, about our buildings, and, you know, but luckily he's very willing to learn.
Yeah.
You know, in other cases, you know, buildings just may not be their thing. Mm-hmm. They could be the most spiritual leader that we have. Mm-hmm. And then buildings just, you know, aren't their thing. So
that's a common thing we end up, I think, circling back to in the podcast, is that, you know, pastors go to seminary not to get an MBA and not to manage multi-million-dollar budgets to be CEOs and not to know really how to, like, organize teams. But all of those things are part of the job.
Yeah, it's on their plate.
Absolutely.
And you don't have to do it yourself. Like, you can deputize professionals or other staff members to do that. And it takes a really exceptional pastor to know what he can do well and what he ought to not do.
Yeah, but the reality, too, where the rubber meets the road in a number of our parishes is that they are so strapped that they don't have any staff.
Yeah.
Right. Get to them.
That's true.
They're the ones replacing
the
light bulbs.
They actually are the ones, you know. Mm-hmm. I was at this one parish not that long ago, and I saw the pastor. I was going to meet the pastor, and he said, I can't, I'm going over here because I've got to find my ladder. And I'm like, oh, Father, please.
He changes the trash and everything else,
He's getting on the roof to do something, you know. Yeah. It's like,
they're
the
facilities manager.
Mm-hmm.
But I have so much respect, you know, for them.
Absolutely.
And I, you know,
they're
doing what's necessary.
Yeah. No,
to
I mean,
keep,
right.
Yeah. I speak.
Keep the lights on.
Typically the parishes we work with are the ones that are bigger. So
yes,
I'm speaking like every priest can deputize someone to do the job, but that's not the case.
It's not the
case. There are some parishes where,
and some of them, you know, most of their people are elderly, and, you know, may have trouble doing some of those tasks at their own home.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it really is. I mean, I have just so much respect for so many of the challenges that our clergy, you know, have right now.
Yeah.
Many fronts.
Neil, that brings up just a question and a thought, which is, it seems like the latest trend in parish design or just church design is bigger parishes, bigger populations. Part of that is, you know, shortage of priests, obviously, driving that. But it seems like, in general, parishes are getting larger, so more people, more staff, and there's more consolidation that is happening. Is that right?
Well, I know it may kind of seem that way, but I think if you think about it and look at it, there's underlying, I believe there's maybe something else going on. There's one phenomenon is the whole master plan community neighborhood kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
so where we have some of our really large churches, it's because of this master plan community phenomenon that's going on, that goes on.
Yeah.
The other thing that I think that's really true, just based on my personal knowledge of some of these places is the places that that are very large have very good leadership in their pastor.
Right.
There is a difference there.
Yeah. Yeah, they tend to be very successful.
And you know, people want to go where they're fed. So just because you open a new church, and we actually have not had very many new parishes in the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could be wrong, but I'm thinking maybe 3 or 4.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Not very many.
Yeah.
So we're not closing any either.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
We're not closing any now. Yeah. I do have occasion. There's a national conference that I go to every year of facility managers of dioceses all over the country, and you know, they'll have these presentations on basically, you know, how the this diocese is disposing of you know, parishes,
40% like of their
in the Northeast. Oh my gosh,
that's what they're doing,
and they're that's happening because a lot of the time they've got it was an ethnic thing. They had like three churches,
Polish,
you know,
and all the ghettos,
and again, you know, their demographics, you know, have changed, and they can't support all these churches. Right. Now, it doesn't always mean that they're tearing the church down.
Right.
What they're consolidating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you know, the only big consolidation we've done like that was after Ike, down in Galveston. And so, but by and large, we're not closing them. And so what that means is, you know, our priests are spread even more thin. So where we used to have in some parishes 2 priests, we only have 1 now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's very difficult for a priest to be, you know, the only priest
one.
There.
Yeah.
So I think that if you were to kind of do a little bit of a study of the mega, you know, churches, they are existing usually because there is some wealth there, they can kind of grow like that. And sometimes their existence is actually sucking
resources
from another church.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So, but be that as it may, the trend may have to be, you know, bigger churches, because the other thing too is people don't want their local parish to close.
Sure. No, yeah, and it's a big deal.
And they will, you know, if they don't understand why that's happening, they will fight against it.
Right,
and
I mean, even after Ike, when some parishes had to close,
well, Galveston,
it was a mess.
Yeah, it is very difficult. And now, you know, now we have a different problem down in Galveston, in that they have these, you know, a number of very historic
old, beautiful churches
that
all need to be maintained.
Maintained, and they have the resources of the equivalent of one parish.
Yeah,
it's a really difficult.
That's
problem.
So
It is very difficult.
It's very difficult.
I got to work on a master plan with them, and it was a difficult problem.
Yes, it is. There's a lot, lot of emotion, a lot of care,
a lot of history, and the thing about the people of Galveston is that. Like they've been living there the whole time. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like here in Houston where people move here and they don't have a sense of history. In Galveston, people do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like people can tell you about their great, great grandfather who went to that parish.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so they care about it that much more.
Yeah,
you know?
They do.
It's crazy.
They do.
Yeah. I got a closer question if you're ready for it.
Yeah.
Let's do it. So, the name of the podcast is Beauty Ever New, right? And it's riffing off of the St. Augustine quote where he's, you know, speaking to God, and he says, "Late have I loved thee, O beauty ever ancient, beauty ever new." Mm-hmm. So in some way, it's the name of the podcast is us reflecting on the way that God relates to us through, I mean, St. Augustine, it's the name of God, basically. It's like beauty ever ancient, beauty ever new. So in thinking about how our buildings are ways of individuals, you know, you and I and our families and our parishes, more broadly speaking, interacting with God through the medium of the building itself. And this is, you know, stepping away from the kind of practicality a little bit. How do you see, can you speak to your role as, you know, someone who's helping form other people and having to figure out how to, you know, build buildings efficiently and effectively and for the long term, how that interfaces with the need that we have for something beautiful, something that's sort of transcendental. And whenever I go to a liturgy and it's, you know, the few times I've been, one of the ways that I'll define it is it was just a beautiful experience. Mm-hmm. And in some way it's not naming a specific thing, but it's just that like it washed over me. How do you see buildings doing that? And
that's an interesting question. I guess that the way I have looked at it, again, every building, you know, kind of has a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to do certain things in a church that you're not going to do, you know, in a building with classrooms or whatnot. And to me, I think that is the more important aspect of it is, mm-hmm. what are we doing? What we're doing in the space is more important than the space, mm-hmm. just for space's purpose. Now I know, you know, I'm one of those people that I love to go into churches. So mm-hmm. if I'm in Europe, oh my gosh, I'm going into all the churches.
Sure.
And so I admire that, but when it comes to, you know, what I'm experiencing in the church, it's sort of like the church doesn't matter, because the experience is more important. So if I am a parent with a preschooler, then yeah, the building's important, but what's happening with my preschooler, you know, being taught about Christ and how to be, you know, in a family, and same thing with my teen, you know, mm-hmm. if I'm taking my teen, you know, to youth group and they're whatever they're experiencing there, you know, the building is the setting for that. It's, it's not the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's part of the thing. We need to have it.
Mm-hmm.
But it can't be,
that's not
everything. Exactly. Cause that's not what we're about. If we're about the buildings, then we've kind of got it. We've got it backwards. And so it was kind of interesting. This might be a little bit of a sideline, but I, had the experience, of helping design a piece of mosaic that was in our last building that we put at St. Lawrence. And, it was being put together over in Florence. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, got to see it, before it was installed over there in Florence. And at the same time, there were some mosaics that were also being designed and fabricated that were going to go in this really fantastic church up in Austin.
Right.
On this dome. And they were overwhelming. I mean, just like I couldn't imagine just like a suburban church having all of this incredible mosaics. I mean, it's like something you would see, you know, in the 3rd century or something.
Right.
And although I was overwhelmed with, you know, how beautiful they were, and then a couple of years later I actually went and saw them installed in that church, there was a little part of me that was just kind of like, why? Now, it's what they wanted, and I'm not questioning their decision, but I know that art would have never happened at my parish, because that's, I mean, we had a little piece. We didn't have, you know, thousands of square feet of that. So I don't know. I don't know if that really answers your question, but I just really want people to think about their spaces in the context of what we're doing there and what we can do there, to bring people to Christ. Because if we're not doing that, then
we're missing the mark.
Right.
Yeah. Go home.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's at the end of the day, is the building supports what happens there.
Exactly.
Not the other way around.
That's right.
Absolutely.
And I think sometimes you can get lost in that.
Yeah. Sometimes, yeah.
That's awesome. Great. Well, thanks for coming out.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Appreciate it very much.
Yeah. Hope it's worth listening to.
Fun. Yeah.
No, this is great. Thank you.